and so unless the doctors were unbelievably good, people had died on the operating tables when the hospital's machines had been diverted to run Staffman's botnet. Governments must have lost a great deal of their monitoring power, as well as their ability to communicate with their militaries. Some would assume they'd been attacked and respond in kind. And on it went. 100 different permutations, his brilliant but insurrectionist brain providing estimates of how many people he'd murdered with the click of a button. "It's done," the coach said. The progress bar on the rightmost monitor had hit 100% and disappeared, replaced by a command line with a slowly blinking cursor.
"Thank God," Staffman said, his voice cracking.
He typed as quickly as his nearly crippled hands would let him, telling the botnet to release control of the world's processors back to their native networks. Yellow and green blooms began to appear on the central monitor, just pinpricks at first in the sea of red, but expanding quickly as Staffman's instructions worked through the system. Staffman gingerly lifted his hands from the keys. He flexed very gently, and the dull, insistent pain flared up into white agony. He grunted.
"Did it work?" the coach asked. "Please, coach. Just one second," he responded weakly.
He was so exhausted that he had to think for a moment to remember the point of the whole exercise. Staffman looked at the monitor on the right, with its seductive blinking cursor, promising the Oracle's secrets, if only he could endure the pain in his hands for a few more moments. He took a deep breath and set his hands back on the keys.
"Yes, it worked," he said. "I'm in. Let me just see what I've found."
He typed, much more slowly than before, his fingers having stiffened up the moment he took a break.
"Hmm,"
he said.
"Hmm,"
the coach said, the impatience in her voice clear. Staffman looked away from the screen.
There's nothing here, coach," he said, his voice quiet.
The coach took one bird-like liver-spotted hand and pushed her thumb and index finger up under her glasses to press on her closed eyelids. After a moment, she removed her hand and let her glasses fall back to the bridge of her nose.
"Explain," she said,
her voice solid steel, all pretense that they were anything other than master and minion gone. Staffman swallowed.
"I'm past the Oracle's security. Every email he received from the site should be stored here. And I assumed there would be other things too, files maybe, data, some sort of clue. But there's nothing. It's just an empty volume. Small, too. Only like 16 megabytes, which is bizarre. It's almost like a..."
His voice trailed off.
"Staffman," the coach said, "did you find something?"
"Maybe," he answered.
He typed again, quickly, the pain in his hands forgotten, then sat back, satisfied. He pointed at the screen.
"We need to go to New Jersey," he said.
Chapter 27.
"Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein. For the time is at hand."
Reverend Hosiah Branson intoned, one hand clutching his Bible, the other outstretched toward the flock of worshippers assembled before him. His eyes were closed, his head upturned to heaven, cleverly placed spotlights surrounding him in a corona of white light no matter where the observer was seated, even the cheap seats. Jonas had seen this tableau 100 times before. He knew the precise moment when Branson would lower his head and begin to speak again, delaying just enough for his audience to sink into a state of blissful anticipation, but not so long that it became awkward or self-conscious. Branson started most of his sermons with this trick, and it always seemed entirely natural, unforced, just a man communing with his own spirituality, gathering himself before giving comfort and guidance to his people. Now, though, watching it through a monitor on his desk deep inside the Branson Ministry, Jonas saw it for what it was. Stagecraft. A performance. A fraud. Branson wouldn't deny it either. All faith was fraud to the good reverend. He'd said as much that evening in his relic-filled sanctuary, and he expected Jonas to simply accept that and continue working as diligently as he ever had to further the ministry's agenda in the world. For the most part, he had. But each time he looked out at the faces of the poor people in the reverend's audiences, he found it impossible to think of them as his congregation any longer, and seen the pure belief on their faces, the pure empty belief. He'd felt it echo within himself. They were so sure that God was real, and that Branson was their conduit to his grace. But they were wrong. About the second part, if not the first. And if they were wrong, how many others were? All over the world, all those billions of believers. Jonas wasn't naive. He knew that charlatans had been taking advantage of humankind's search for something higher than itself for thousands and thousands of years. But he'd always assumed it was an exceptional thing, not the norm. Now, though, it was as if Branson's revelations had flipped the world into something like a photo negative, and he couldn't see his way back to the light. On the monitor, Branson lowered his head, opened his eyes, and began to preach.
"Welcome to the end times, my brothers and sisters," he shouted. "The final act of the great play, Judgment Day, when the sinners are cast down to burn in the lake of fire, and the faithful travel up to join God in heaven, and all good Christians will know the pure joy of His presence. Our job in all of that is simple, my friends. If we avoid wickedness and help guide our fellows to righteousness, we'll get to see that Judgment Day show from the best seats in the whole darned arena. The skybox in the truest sense. We'll get called up early, in body and spirit, when that trumpet sounds at the rapture. And I will see you all there. That's one journey we'll make together."
The audience erupted into cheers and hosannas and hallelujahs. Of course they did. Branson was reminding them they were better than everyone else. Jonas hated himself for thinking something so cynical, but ideas like that came to him constantly now. If Branson was a fraud, then he was a fraud. Everyone was a fraud. Almost everyone, he thought. Jonas glanced at his phone, feeling the temptation to check his email. The phone was set to chime whenever a new message came in, so he knew there hadn't been anything new since he last checked. But still. Instead, he turned back to the stack of papers on his desk, correspondence from the Detectives for Christ initiative Branson had started up some time back as a grassroots effort to track down the Oracle's identity. The project had been wildly successful, at least from a purely participatory perspective. Every one of the ministry's faithful from Topeka to Tallahassee was peeping in their neighbors' windows looking for the evil oracle. And in a surprising twist, the vast majority of the detectives did, in fact, find their quarry. Or they were fairly certain they had, and wanted to tell Branson about their discovery, and asked for his guidance on how to handle the situation. Every day a mountain of correspondence poured into the offices of the Branson Ministry. Email, handwritten letters, packages, phone calls. Jonas had been tasked with coordinating the effort to deal with the deluge. Initially, Jonas had assigned one intern to go through the materials the ministry's congregation sent in, the leads as they had inevitably become known. Now there were three, each pulling 12-hour days parsing through the endless chaff, looking for even the tiniest bit of wheat. Most of it was simple to handle, like an email from a woman convinced that the lucky win on bingo night by that dirty cheater Doris Hansen meant that poor Mrs. Hansen was quite obviously the oracle. But some of it was not so obviously misguided, and Jonas needed to review those communications to see if they might contain an actual clue to the Oracle's identity. The interns weren't supposed to send leads up the chain to Jonas unless something looked quite promising. But none of them wanted to be accused of missing something important, so they ended up sending much more to his desk than they should. Hence, the stack of paperwork on Jonas's desk, and the reason he was watching the Reverend's sermon through a monitor on his desk as opposed to standing backstage watching it live. Once, being so far from Hosiah Branson's presence would have bothered Jonas immensely. Now, though, he didn't mind all that much. The farther the better, in fact.
"You all know the signs," Branson said through the monitor, lifting a solemn hand out toward his audience. "The comet Wormwood appearing in the skies, the Antichrist slouching his terrible oozing way toward Bethlehem, the seas of blood, all the rest. But I ask you to think for one moment. The words of the Book of Revelation were set down almost 2,000 years ago by the good Apostle John. He was imprisoned on the island of Patmos, waiting for the end of his life, when God sent him a vision of how it would all go down. It seems to me that God perhaps showed St. John things he didn't quite understand. This was a long time ago, after all. John did his level best to explain what he saw, to give us God's message. But what if he simply didn't have the words for it? You know what happened 5 days ago. The world went dark. The power went out, and our machines failed us. Death was visited on all the lands of the earth. Tens of thousands have died in the last few days in every country. In fact, I can feel that some of you in this very room and those watching me from your homes have lost people in this crisis. For that I offer you my deepest sympathy, and my assurance is that you will see your loved ones again, soon."
Hosiah paused and bowed his head. He removed a crystal white handkerchief from his lapel pocket and ran it across his perfectly dry brow before continuing. "Do I hate him?" Jonas thought. "I might. I really might." Jonas picked up the next sheet of paper from the stack. "Dear Reverend," it began. He sighed heavily and started to plow through the theories of one Donnie Winston from North Carolina. Donnie seemed to favor tying the Oracle by his ankles to the back of his pickup and dragging him through the streets from town to town, making stops for him to be stoned by the good, God-fearing folk along the way.
"Like they done with St. Paul,"
Donnie concluded, failing to realize that the people doing the stoning in that instance were not generally seen to be the heroes of the story. He slashed a large red X across the page with a pen conveniently placed for the purpose and set it into an outbox atop the other rejected leads.
"It is not only death that concerns us today," Branson went on. "It is also war. You've heard of the terrible fighting on the plains of Central Asia, in Kandustan. Our Christian brothers have been forced to defend themselves against the Muslims, who took the opportunity offered by the dark days to invade. And the Philippines, that good, God-fearing country, torn asunder by rioting and fear as the military pulled power from their president. And, of course, our own soldiers in the armed forces of this great country, stitching together the blanket of freedom in Africa and the Middle East. I could list many others, but I'm not here to talk about that kind of news. The only news I'm going to give you is the good news. Straight from the Lord to you. And this is good news, my brothers and sisters. For when you hear talk of death and talk of war, and when you know famine and pestilence cannot be far behind,
What does that sound like to you?
Jonas considered. Branson was a liar, but he had a point. The world did seem like it had a dark cloud covering it these days.
Why, the Reverend said, ramping up his intensity. It sounds to me like the four horsemen come a-ridin'. Not the riders of the Dusty Sage, not the cavalry, but the riders of the apocalypse. This is the end of days, my fellow children of God, and I am so pleased to be your source of guidance in this time of trial.
The crowd, hushed until this moment, boiled over, becoming a cauldron of exaggerated cries of fear, pledges to Jesus, devotions and exhortations and covenants offered.
Oh, yes, Branson said, his amplified voice cutting through the din. This is it. Prepare your souls for God's reckoning. Brothers and sisters, he shouted, calm yourselves. You are all bathed in God's light. These days should be days of hope, of anticipation, not fear. If there's one thing I know, it's that good people go to heaven, and you, my friends, he spread his arms wide, are good people.
Branson dropped his arms. He let his face grow serious.
But there's another thing. You know that the Bible talks of an Antichrist, an evil beast that will stalk the earth in the days before Jesus' return. I tell you, he's already here. We've talked about him before, and I'm ashamed to say that I underestimated the threat to goodness that he posed. Someone out there knows who I'm talking about. Shout it out to me, right now.
Jonas clicked off the monitor. He lifted his phone, swiped it open, and checked his email. Nothing. He stared at the screen for a moment, then placed it face down on his desk and returned to work. Chapter 28 Jonathan Staffman grabbed a backpack containing his toolkit. Customized Raspberry Pi processors designed to inject zombifying malware into any number of common electronic lock systems, a few laptops filled with his preferred code-breaking algorithms, and even a set of analog lockpicks, just in case. He stepped out of the back of the overheated stuffy van into the cold air of an April dawn, breathing in the comparatively refreshing scents of Bayonne, New Jersey, with some relief. The sunrise-tinged Statue of Liberty was visible to the north, and lower Manhattan beyond, their majesty a stark contrast to their immediate surroundings, a self-storage park on the banks of the Hudson River. Rows of modular steel bins of varying sizes, painted orange with blue shutter doors, stretched out in either direction. The complex was deserted. That was intentional. The main reason they had gotten there so early. The coach appeared next to him, along with two large, dark-suited men of unclear job description, whom she hadn't seen fit to introduce. Staffman had the sense that it was unusual for the coach to attend a mission like this personally. The large gentlemen were probably her security team, a conclusion strongly supported by their air of competent menace. "Which way?" she said. Staffman pointed, and the group set out toward Unit 909. "Is this what you expected to find?" the coach asked, gesturing out at the storage units around them.
"Honestly, no," Staffman answered, as they made their way down the row, their shoes squelching in the mud. "I was thinking it would be a warehouse, maybe. But this could make sense, too. Some of these units are wired. This company rents them out for all kinds of things, not just storage. Cheap office space, even some light manufacturing, 3D printing outfits, lots of stuff. Some of them have internet and power. It's not fancy, but it's cheap. And my guess is that whoever runs this place doesn't ask too many questions." Two turns and a short walk deeper into the maze, and they arrived at Unit 909, where the third member of the coach's security team waited, holding the packet sniffer he'd used to zero in on the IP address from the Oracle's email address. A heavy padlock and thick chain hung from the shutter door.
"Anything?" the coach asked her man.
"Nothing. Quiet in there. The lock doesn't look like it's been disturbed for a while either."
She stepped back, thinking.
"All right. The Oracle isn't here. That's obvious. But maybe we'll just have a little look. See what we can see."
Staffman breathed a sigh of relief. The coach's men were carrying guns. He'd seen them beneath their coats, and he had no interest in being anywhere near any sort of firefight or battle or whatever the security team was thinking might happen that would require them to be armed. He swung his shoulder bag around and started rooting around in it for his lockpicks.
"I can get through that lock," he said as he searched.
"Can I help you?" a new voice said from a little farther up the room. Staffman turned, freezing as he saw a small, dark-skinned man in jeans and a light jacket. An orange and blue sweatshirt emblazoned with the logo of the self-storage company was visible beneath the coat. He glanced to one side, expecting the coach to order her security team to gun the man down. And indeed, one of them was reaching inside his coat. Staffman opened his mouth, desperately hoping he could say something that would prevent another death being added to the considerable tally he already had on his head from the blackouts. He felt the coach's hand, tight on his upper arm. He looked over, where he saw that her kindly old grandma persona had reappeared, anchored by a reassuring, friendly smile. The fight, if that was what it could be called, went out of him. Staffman relaxed, resigning himself to whatever happened next. The coach had said it back when this all began. Dr. Jonathan Staffman was no hero. The coach's man removed something from inside his blazer, not a pistol, but a slim leather wallet, which he flipped open to show to the storage company's security guard.
"FBI, sir," he said. "We're here as part of an ongoing investigation."
He handed the badge to the guard, who inspected it before handing it back. Staffman wondered if the man might actually be an FBI agent. Knowing the coach, it was entirely possible.
"All right," said the security guard, "but you should have checked in with me first. How can I help you?"
The FBI agent, false or real, turned and pointed at Unit 909.
"We need to get in there right away," he said. "Do you have a key?"
"Of course. But you can't get in without a warrant. We take that stuff seriously around here."
Staffman assumed that was probably because they had their share of illegal businesses operating in the complex, which was neither here nor there to him. In a way, he respected the man's integrity.
"Sure, of course," the coach said, speaking for the first time.
She had her cell phone in her hand and was tapping its face.
"Do you have a fax number here?"
The guard rattled off 10 digits, which the coach apparently memorized on hearing once. She stepped away, spoke a few quiet words into her phone, then returned to the group.
"You should have your warrant in about 5 minutes, she said.
It took 3. The guard reviewed the papers, nodded, produced the padlock key and handed it over, asking only that they return it when they were done. The lock fell open, and one of the coach's men lifted the storage unit's door, sliding it up on its track. All 4 men and 1 woman crowded around the door, eager to see what had been hidden so securely, what had cost so many lives to find. Paper. Drifts of white copy paper covered the entire floor of the unit in a chaotic pile, several inches deep, sloping up to cover a back corner of the unit to a height of several feet. Thousands of pages, tens of thousands. Staffman bent and picked up a sheet. One side was covered with finely printed text. He recognized the familiar formatting of a printed email. Sender header with the outgoing email address, date and time it was sent, and the subject line. In this case, just 1 word. Please. He continued reading, aware in his peripheral vision that the coach and her team had each picked up their own sheets of paper.
If you could just tell me the next few Super Bowl winners or any big sporting event, really, I wouldn't be greedy. I'd just bet enough to get my family back on its feet. It's been really tough the past few years, and...
Staffman skimmed the rest, a tale of bad luck and illness and woe. A desperate bid for sympathy that had ended up ignored in a New Jersey storage unit. He lifted his eyes from the paper, realizing what the unit actually held.
"These are the questions," he said, "from the site."
The coach looked up from her own sheet and nodded.
"Must be," she said, "but it can't be all of them. There's a lot here, sure, but he must have received millions of questions. Billions."
Staffman waded into the storage unit, slipping and sliding on other people's dreams as he made his way to the back corner. Before he'd even made it halfway, he set off a cascade that caused the higher stack of printouts in the corner to slide away, revealing what he knew he'd see. A heavy-duty industrial printer, the kind used at office service companies and print centers, designed to run non-stop, all day long, doing high-volume jobs. As Staffman drew closer, he could see lights blinking on the machine's display, indicating both a low ink supply and an empty paper bin, a secondary unit that had apparently held many thousands of pages, designed to continue working independently for days, even weeks, without a resupply.
"What are we looking at?" the coach asked from behind him.
Staffman's mouth twisted. All this way, everything he'd done, everything he'd have to live with for the rest of his life. For a dead end.
"This is where the questions went when people sent them to the site. They came to this printer. It must have an internet connection. And then they were printed. The machine just went ahead and did that until it ran out of paper."
"I understand that, Dr. Staffman. I would like to know why the Oracle did this."
Staffman squatted down, inspecting the printer.
"I don't know, Coach. Maybe the email address was a ruse of some kind. Or, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense."
The coach grunted, her disapproval clear. Staffman heard her speaking quietly to one of her men. Staffman focused, trying to think through the system, trying to understand why the Oracle would have set it up. He moved laboriously to the back of the machine, shoving away drifts of Oracle questions in order to access the printer's ports. And then he saw it. Staffman reached down and plucked a thumb drive from a USB port on the back of the printer and held it up. He smiled. The coach's man returned with the security guard. Staffman walked out of the unit, holding the flash drive carefully, cradling it like a robin's egg, only dimly aware of what the guard was telling the coach.
"I'm sorry," he heard him say. "This tenant paid in cash for a year up front. We take names and contact information, but I'll be honest with you, we don't verify any of that for cash transactions. We only do it if they're paying with credit. You can have what I've got, but I wouldn't expect it to pan out."
"Security footage?" the coach asked.
"We only keep it for 2 weeks," the guard answered. "And I can tell you, no one's been in this unit for a lot longer than that."
"Well, that is not very helpful," the coach said, her tone dark. "Not very helpful at all."
Staffman tuned out the rest of the conversation. He was sitting on the cold ground outside the storage unit, one of his notebook computers open on his lap, poking around inside the flash drive. It wasn't even encrypted. They probably couldn't, he thought. The printer's too dumb to deal with encryption. The drive held just a few very simple lines of code, macros, operating instructions telling the machine how to manage its print buffer, its short-term memory. The printer was set up to receive jobs via email. Ordinarily, those tasks were stored in an onboard hard drive, which allowed for a great many options for the printer's operators. Many jobs could be queued, or they could be retrieved and reprinted if an error occurred. The code on the flash drive told the printer to bypass that system entirely. All incoming emails were sent directly to the printer's buffer, where they were held only long enough for the job to be printed, then erased. He had assumed something like this would be the case when he first cracked the Oracle's email address. He'd expected a massive storage system holding terabytes of data, all those emails stored in a huge database. Instead, he'd seen something tiny, well under 100 megabytes. That meant, probably, that the emails were being offloaded somewhere else, but the network trail had stopped dead. So the emails were either being deleted, which didn't make sense, or they were being transitioned to hard copy. They were being printed. Staffman didn't know why the Oracle had chosen to set things up this way. He presumed that the Oracle, or his people, had intended to clear away the printed emails on a regular basis, but obviously that plan had faltered in some way. Not that any of this was useful, nor would it help him locate the Oracle. He looked up at the coach, who was giving instructions to her men. The woman paused and looked at Staffman. Her gaze was cold, shark-like. She held Staffman's eyes for a moment, freezing him down to his spine, then turned back and continued talking to her team. He knew how the coach worked. Do what she asked and you would be rewarded, comfortable for the rest of your days. Fail her, and even if she let you live, she would use her apparently endless levels of influence to ruin your life, so that the next time she came calling, you'd be so desperate that you would do whatever she wanted, without question. Staffman turned his eyes back to his laptop, scanning through the code on the flash drive for anything that could help him, any clue at all. But there was nothing. It was just two lines of incredibly simple programming. But, no. There was more. A few lines of header text, the sort of thing many programmers inserted into their code as a sort of signature, the same way emails might have a generic sign-off at the end of the relevant text. Staffman hadn't even registered it at first. It was so common that he skimmed over it without thinking, looking for the meat of the program, the lines that actually did something. But he looked now, and he saw that the signature consisted of a single phrase, a very particular phrase. Women, by their nature, are not exceptional chess players. They are not great fighters. His eyes widened. He knew that quote. Garry Kasparov had said it. He also remembered the woman who'd placed those words up on a little sign over her desk, from 25 years earlier when they'd both been working at Park. She'd put up the sign, and she'd always inserted the phrase into her code, too. She had apparently thought she was making some kind of point. Well, good fighter or not, she'd just lost. Coach, he said, looking up, relief flooding through him. I know the woman you want. I can tell you all about her. Either she's the Oracle, or she knows him. Well, good, the coach said, smiling, her eyes suddenly warm again. I'm sure we'll be able to track her down without any trouble. Good job, Dr. Staffman. She turned back to her men and gave them a significant look. Looks like the tech team's done. Time for the field team. Chapter 29. Kathy Jenkins rinsed tiny chamomile-smelling bubbles of soap off her hands. She shook the excess droplets of water into the sink and turned off the brass faucets. She looked at her reflection in the mirror and frowned, placing her index finger on her cheek. She pulled down the skin under her eye, smoothing out the wrinkles. Tired. Or maybe just old. Kathy fussed with her hair, thinking about lunch. Becky was down in the kitchen getting it ready. They would eat on the back deck while watching the seagulls dive. She smiled at herself in the mirror, looking old but feeling young. Nothing from her 20-plus years of contented marriage to Bill Jenkins, nothing from the quarter century before that, had ever shown a glimmer that she'd end up in love with a 50-something fellow widow. But then again, she'd never expected to be in love again at all after Bill died. So all things considered, Mrs. Shubman had turned out to be quite the wonderful little surprise. Kathy opened the bathroom door and stepped into the upstairs hall. She looked critically at the slight patch of wear running down the center of the beige carpet as she walked toward the stairs leading down to the living room. She was starting to think she might redo the rest of the house. Just do the whole damn thing. Why not? She had $5 million. She could afford it, thank you, John Bianco. Or Will Dando. Whichever. She started down the stairs.
Becky, she called from halfway down the stairs. Is lunch ready? I'll set the table out back, if you don't need any help in the kitchen.
Kathy stopped with 1 foot halfway to the next step, hovering in the air. Her hand tightened around the banister. 6 men, all in khaki pants and short-sleeved pastel dress shirts, stood looking up at her, waiting. 4 of them carried long black guns, shotguns, she guessed, and the remainder held pistols with elongated cylinders attached to the barrels that she recognized from movies as silencers. The shotguns were pointed directly at her, and the eyes of the men holding them were hard.
Turn. Run back upstairs. Lock a door. Find a phone. Turn. Run back upstairs. Lock a door. Find a phone.
Kathy didn't move. Slowly she processed another piece of information that her eyes had been trying to feed her since she got her first view of her violated living room. Becky was on the couch, sitting next to her, in a pose that would almost have been companionable but for the gunmen in the room, was a woman. She was older, probably in her 60s, maybe well-kept 70s, and elegant. She wore a black suit with a blue scarf tied around her neck. She looked utterly ordinary, like a PR executive, perhaps. Everything was ordinary, except for the guns.
Mrs. Jenkins, the woman said pleasantly. I'm the coach. Will you come join us, please?
Kathy's foot landed heavily on the step below her, and she almost stumbled. She caught herself with a hand on the wall, and felt a fingernail bend back. Ignoring the pain, Kathy walked unsteadily down the remaining steps and into the living room. She passed 2 of the pastel and khaki gunmen, who moved to stand between her and the stairs. She could see Becky's face much more clearly now. Terror. Nothing else. Her eyes flicked back and forth wildly between her captor, Kathy, and the gunmen.
I write code, for God's sake, Kathy thought, desperate. What is this?
But she knew, of course.
Sit down just there, the coach said.
She gestured to the other couch.
You too, Mrs. Shubman.
Becky looked at her, her face confused. The coach smiled gently at her and gave her a slight push on the shoulder. Becky stood and stumbled around the glass-topped coffee table to the other couch. Kathy sat down next to her. Through the picture windows that looked out onto the beach, she could see sunbathers and people walking hand in hand off in the distance. As soon as Kathy sat down, she reached for Becky's hand and met it as it grasped across the cushions for her own.
Are you all right?
She whispered. Becky nodded, but she didn't talk, and Becky Shubman never stopped talking.
I apologize for the intrusion, ladies, the coach said. We'll be out of here just as soon as possible. Before anything else, let me say the thing people in these situations always say. In this case, though, it's the truth. I promise. We don't want to hurt you.
She interlaced her fingers, nails painted a shade of blue that nicely complemented her scarf. She raised her eyebrows and tapped her thumbs a few times, as if considering how to begin. Kathy watched her, and to her surprise, felt impatient.
Please, she said. What do you want? Money?
The coach's mouth quirked. Her eyes looked almost amused.
Do we look like we're here for money?
I don't know,
Kathy said. Becky squeezed her hand.
Relax, Mrs. Jenkins, the coach said. We just want information. We know that at least you, and probably both of you, set up data security for the Oracle. We need to know who engaged you to do this.
Becky's grip tightened another notch. The coach leaned forward.
This doesn't have to go the intimidation route either. You can just think of it as a job. We're happy to pay you for your help, in fact.
I don't know what you're talking about, Kathy said. Who the hell are you?
The coach sighed. She held out her hand, and one of the gunmen placed his pistol in her palm. The coach held the weapon up, displaying it to the women. To Kathy, it looked singularly ugly. It gleamed dully like some sort of malevolent metal insect.
Personally, the coach said, weapons like this scare the hell out of me. The idea of killing someone is horrible. You never get tough about it. I remember everyone I've ever had to kill, or even hurt. Whatever lives they had left, whatever moments of happiness they had left, disappeared because of me.
She handed the pistol back to the gunman.
In my heart, I don't believe I'm a killer. However, she said, gesturing at the stony crew standing around them, these men certainly are. And every one of them is completely fine with that label. I want you both to understand that, and be frightened. Because the last thing I want to do today is walk out of here with another face or two to keep me up at night. I'm going to ask you a few questions, and I'd like you to answer me honestly. That doesn't seem like too much to ask, does it?
A sickening suspicion began to dawn in Kathy's mind, related to a certain turn of phrase she might have inserted into her program code for the Oracle's email system. Just a reflex, something she included in almost everything she created. The coach pointed her index finger, with the nail painted that incongruous shade of royal blue, directly at Kathy's face.
Here's why you want to answer honestly, she said.
She shifted her finger to point at Becky.
Because of what I'll do to Mrs. Shubman if you don't.
The coach's eyes were sincere, open, without guile.
Imagine Mrs. Jenkins, feeling her hands on you, feeling the missing fingers, and know that they're missing because of a choice you made, assuming you get to feel them at all. Hands come after fingers.
Becky's hand clenched on Kathy's. Kathy bowed her head. She looked at Becky.
I told her we don't know anything, but she didn't believe me,
Becky whispered. Her voice was tiny, like a child's.
What are we going to do?
The coach waited patiently. Kathy smiled sadly at Becky.
His name is Will Dando. He lives in New York, she said,
not looking anywhere but Becky's face.
I don't know if he's the Oracle or just works for him, but I think he's probably who you want. He's listed. I can get you the number if you want it.
Becky sucked in a little breath. Kathy had never told her that she'd figured out John Bianco's real name. She felt Becky's hand loosen on hers.
Thank you, the coach said. We'll want to verify what you've told us, but it shouldn't take long. And then you'll never have to see us again. And isn't it better this way?
Kathy saw Becky's eyes narrow. She cocked her head at the coach, who was dialing a cell phone she had produced from within her suit. Very deliberately, Becky extended her hand toward the other woman. She slowly, elegantly curled down all but her middle finger, leaving it standing straight up. Chapter 30. Lee Shore left room 1952 of the Waldorf Astoria and turned right. She walked down the broad, silent hallway, feeling the slightly imperfect fit of her entirely new set of clothes, a light gray skirt suit, well cut, with every step. It needed a touch of tailoring, but really it wasn't bad, and it was certainly more expensive than any other clothing she owned. There had been three differently sized versions of the suit in room 1952, along with underwear and shoes. Lee had picked the best fits from the available options, disrobing completely in front of the obviously embarrassed pregnant Asian woman she'd met there. The woman had explained the rules and taken her purse, jewelry, not that she was wearing much, cell, laptop bag, and clothes. Lee was given a brand new laptop, a notepad, and a few sharpened pencils, and directed to head to room 1964. And now that door stood before her, waiting. Her legs were tingling. Why was that? That made no sense. Lee stared at the door, trying to calm herself, trying to focus. It wasn't working. And so, what? Leave? No, absolutely not. She reached up and knocked. A shadow moved behind the peephole in the door, blocking the light momentarily. The impulse to run gripped Lee, so strongly that she half-turned before she gathered herself. A click from the door handle, and then the door opened. A man, white, on the youngish side by complexion, although these days that could mean anything from 20s to 40s. Jeans, nice ones, a button-down shirt tucked in, good shoes, all of which broadcast a picture of casual wealth, sunglasses, and a mop of light blonde hair. That's a wig, she thought. He's wearing a disguise. Miss Shore, the man said. The Oracle? Lee said, hesitating a bit. That's right, the man said. Very pleased to meet you, Lee said. She extended her hand and received a brief, firm shake in return. Come in, the Oracle said. Have a seat over there, couch or chair, doesn't matter. Lee moved inside, seeing a large, well-appointed room with a separate sitting area, a suite. A tray with snacks and drinks sat on a wooden coffee table between a couch and two armchairs. Lee sat on the couch, placing the laptop and notepad on the cushion beside her. Can I offer you anything? The Oracle said. There's soda, water. Anything you want from the minibar. She realized that he was nervous too, and felt herself starting to relax. The Oracle, whatever else he might be, was clearly a human being. Lee smiled at him, a big 50,000-kilowatt smile, one of the most potent weapons in her arsenal. Just water, thanks. The Oracle clinked a few cubes of ice into a glass from the silver bucket on the tray, then filled the glass with water. He handed it to Lee and sat in one of the armchairs.
Thank you for seeing me, Lee said. I'm glad we were able to put this together.
It's my pleasure, the Oracle said. Lee smiled again and took a sip of water. An awkward silence descended. Well, good, the Oracle said. Would you like to, get started?
Absolutely, Lee answered, putting her glass on the table and picking up the laptop.
She flipped it open.
How much time do we have?
As much as we need, the Oracle said. Lee's eyebrows raised, but she nodded. A short burst of typing on the laptop, and then she gave the man sitting opposite her a look she hoped was direct and businesslike.
First question, she said. What do I call you? Are you comfortable with Oracle?
The man gave an embarrassed shrug.
He's such a person, she marveled. Almost ordinary.
That's probably easiest for now, I guess. It's a little goofy, I know.
But it's accurate, right? It's like calling a man who puts out fires a fireman. You are an Oracle, after all. You see the future and you tell us about it.
The Oracle nodded. Fair enough.
Next, and this is off the record, just something I'd like to know. That business in the other room. Everything I brought with me is back there, and...
Oh, of course, the Oracle said. He pulled a plastic card from his pocket and held it out. This is the key to 1952. You can get your things when we're done here. And I'm sorry about the security stuff, too, but you understand. Lee took the key card and slipped it into the breast pocket of her suit.
I do, I get it. Not even an audio recorder, though? That's pretty standard equipment for an interview like this.
The Oracle reached out and grabbed a pretzel from the tray. He chewed slowly, swallowed.
I don't want my voice on tape. That's why we gave you the laptop, Ms. Shore. You can take all the notes you want. We'll review them once we're done here to make sure the quotes are accurate. Then you get them back on a thumb drive.
Lee nodded. She extended her hands over the keyboard, then pulled them back.
Last question before we start. What makes you think people will believe me about any of this? She said. I won't have any evidence that we met, other than my word. For a lot of people, that won't be enough. After all, Lee continued, I'm not exactly Barbara Walters. I'm not even TMZ.
The Oracle leaned forward.
I've read your work. You're selling yourself short, he said. But I'll do two things. I'll put something up on the side about this interview so that people know it's legitimate. And second, I'll give you a prediction tonight that you can put in your story to prove that you met me.
Lee felt her face go slack. The Oracle just watched from behind his sunglasses. And no, he was definitely not ordinary.
That would work, I think, Lee said.
The Oracle smiled and leaned back in his chair.
I think so. But you must have a lot of questions for me. Go ahead.
All right, Oracle, Lee began.
He winced, his forehead wrinkling.
That's terrible, he interrupted. I didn't realize how awful that would sound. Just call me Jim, all right? That will work as well as anything.
Jim it is, Lee said. So, the first question, the first real question, she continued, is pretty simple. How do you predict the future?
The Oracle hesitated. To Lee, it seemed as if he was thinking about how to respond, which seemed strange. He had to have known this would be something she would ask. He looked off to one side, smiling a little, as if sharing a private joke with himself. He sighed, then looked back to Lee.
I don't know, the Oracle answered. I dreamed all of this.
Lee looked up from the laptop.
You dreamed it, she said, very focused.
Yes, about 8 months ago. Voices spoke to me in my head while I was asleep. A little later, I noticed that the things I dreamed were starting to come true. His mouth twitched. And here we are.
Lee almost felt drunk.
These were the answers. What everyone wanted to know. But a dream? A dream.
For the first time, she wondered whether the answers she would get might not be the answers she or anyone else would want.
Have there been any other dreams since then?
No. Just that one set of predictions. But they go out for a long while from now. Hundreds of them.
Why not release all of them at once? Why parcel them out like you have?
The predictions came to me. I'm using my best judgment about what to do with them.
So you came up with the site on your own?
I've had some help from some people close to me. I couldn't do what I'm doing without them.
I don't suppose you want to tell me who any of them are?
The Oracle nodded.
Sure, want their cell numbers? Hold on. I'll read them off slowly.
A pause. Lee looked up from her keys.
Nah, he said, his tone light.
Right,
Lee said. She smiled as she said it, but she could hear a snappish tone in her voice. She flexed her fingers.
Do you want to stop for a little while? The Oracle asked.
No, that's all right. Just a bunch of quick typing. I'm fine, Jim, she said.
Lee leaned forward.
Three things, Lee said.
The Oracle nodded.
First, why do you think you were sent this information? Second, do you know who sent it? And if so, who is it?
Lee said.
And finally, what are you actually doing with the predictions? You mentioned a moment ago that you're relying on your judgment. What exactly does that mean? For months, rumors have persisted that you're selling information about the future to wealthy individuals. That doesn't seem particularly altruistic.
The Oracle crossed his legs, resting his ankle on his knee. He looked out the window, and Lee followed his gaze, out across the roofs of the west side of Midtown. The Oracle looked back at Lee. His face was solemn, and he contorted it into what looked a little bit like a smile. "I'll answer your second question first," he said. "I have no idea who sent me the predictions. Maybe there's some code or pattern in them that would give me the answer. But if there is, I'm too stupid to see it." "There are only a few possibilities," he continued. "Number one, someone out there in the future sent all this information back to me. Or maybe someone in the present sent me a list of things they were planning to do, and they're making all the predictions come true, one after the other. Or no one's behind it at all, and it's all just some sort of accident of physics."
"Surely you have some guess, though," Lee said. "You've been living with these predictions for more than half a year. If you had to gamble on one of your three theories, which would it be?"
He smiled. "I'm the Oracle. There's no such thing as gambling when you know the future. Anyway, it doesn't matter. How I got the information and even why I got it isn't important. It's about what I do with it. Let's say I read a book that, teaches me how to weave a rug. Does it matter if I bought that book or checked it out from the library or, hell, stole it? No. What makes a difference is whether I go out and weave a rug, or if I just let the information sit in my brain. Taken to the next level, it's how I use the rug once I've woven it. Do I sell it? Do I keep it? Do I give it away?" Lee took that down and read over her last few paragraphs.
"Okay. So what are you actually doing with the predictions? Why did you create the site?"
Again, the Oracle paused before responding. It felt to Lee like he was going off script, moving away from whatever answer he'd originally planned to give, which raised the question, had he shifted toward the truth or lies? The site was part of a bigger plan to attract buyers for the predictions. It was a way to ease the world into the idea that someone out there could see the future.
"Did that work?" she said, typing.
"Yes," he answered. "The Oracle has made over $14 billion. Lee's hands froze.
"So that's really all this is about? Just money?" she said, not looking up from her screen. She could hear disappointment in her voice.
"No, something more profound. Disillusionment. That's where it started."
"And now?"
"It's more than that," the Oracle said. "I've used the money to do things that haven't been made public. I've given away over a third of that cash. To charities, anonymous donations, things like that." Lee raised an eyebrow.
"That has to make you the largest charitable donor in history. Why?"
The Oracle smiled. "What the fuck am I going to do with $14 billion that I can't do with 9? It didn't seem right to take all that good fortune and not do something for other people." The Oracle reached up under his sunglasses, careful not to knock them off, and rubbed at his eyes. "Also," he said, "I'm trying to make up for killing 12 people when this whole thing started." Lee's reporter's instincts lit up, even as her disappointment in what the Oracle was turning out to be deepened.
"What?" she managed.
"You remember the Lucky Corner massacre?"
"Of course," Lee said cautiously. "It was huge news. Last year. Like 8 months ago."
"I did that." Lee thought for a moment, trying to remember the details.
"But wasn't it just a bodega robbery that went bad over on 9th? A couple of patrol cops walked into the store while it was happening. I don't remember exactly how it played out, but..."
"The bad guys saw the cops and started shooting," the oracle said, his voice dull. First, the owner of the deli. His name was Hanwoo Park, the oracle went on. Then one of the patrolmen, Officer Leonard Esposito. His partner made it out of the store and called for backup.